corporate social responsibility. The topic was selected to qualify for continuing education credit for CPA Ontario. Unlike the legal ethics classes that we do in the medical ethics ones, CPA Ontario does not pre-approve sessions for credit. So you just pick your topic based on what they generally approve. And I haven't had a problem. I've been doing this for quite a few years. I want to thank the Byatt for approaching me about doing this session. Thank you, Elaine Genesov, in particular, for setting it up. Also, Liora and Michelle Grinbaum and Ruth and Joseph Rudner, who dedicated this class with their donations from our Day of Giving that we held this past summer. So again, for those who are just joining now, I am going to put the link in the chat again for downloading the source sheet. And again, I'll ask people to please, if you didn't sign in advance, then just send me a message in the chat confirming that you are here. If you did not get the email promoting this class last week, then please make sure that you send me your email address as well, and that way I'll be able to let you know about future classes and send you follow-up from this one. So again, our topic is corporate social responsibility. So the first question that we have to ask before we get into the topic proper is, what is corporate social responsibility? What are we talking about? Actually, before I ask people to answer that also, I am recording the session. Nonetheless, if you're comfortable being on camera, that would be great. It's a lot easier for me to speak when I'm talking to faces as opposed to gray boxes with white writing on them. So if you're comfortable on a Sunday morning being visible, great. I'm here. Okay. So now, how would you define corporate social responsibility? What definition would you give? Uh-oh, a lot of people are mute. That's not good. So I'm going to offer a definition now, but that's not going to exempt people from talking later on. Corporate social responsibility, generally speaking, is a policy that a corporation obviously has that is meant to shape the policies of the organization to be sensitive to the values of the surrounding society. Those policies can be in terms of hiring, in terms of investment, in terms of production of goods, in terms of marketing, in terms of distribution, all the different ways in which a company functions. The corporation, under this principle of corporate social responsibility, is supposed to make sure that its policies are going to be sensitive to the values of the society that they inhabit. And the problem with corporate social responsibility, because right now when you just say that sentence, it sounds really nice, like all sweetness and light, what's not to like? The problem with corporate social responsibility is that there is a fundamental potential conflict of interest. What's the conflict of interest when you're talking about corporate social responsibility?
What might be best for the world, might not be best for your client or the company.
Yeah. Right. When we talk about what society likes all sorts of things. They aren't necessarily good for your corporation as a business entity. The society may say, we want the minimum wage to be fill in the blank. We think that it's really important for society to have a minimum wage that's going to be, forget $15 an hour, $30 an hour. And how many corporations will you have left? So this is a fundamental question, and I'm not weighing in on minimum wage. I'm not an economist, and don't pretend to be. But the point is that society can demand all sorts of things that may not be in the best interests of a particular corporation. Now, the argument can be made, and the argument is made that corporate social responsibility is important for the good of business. If you take a look on your sheet, source number one, and I put the link again in the chat for the source sheet, from the Business Development Bank of Canada, which is itself an arm of the government of Canada, although operating at arm's length. They write the following: corporate social responsibility is a company's commitment to manage the social, environmental, and economic effects of its operations responsibly and in line with public expectations. Right? So you're going to be responsible and in line with public expectations. I'd like to unpack at some point responsible versus public expectations, but not right now. It is part of a company's approach to corporate governance and often touches every part of the business: operations, human resources, manufacturing, supply chain, health and safety, and more. May include company policies that insist on working with partners who follow ethical business practices, reinvesting profits in health and safety or environmental, environmental programs, supporting charitable organizations in the communities where a company operates, promoting equal opportunities for men and women at the executive level. Some aspects may be required by law. For example, banks and hospitals are legally required to protect people's private information. Others are voluntary. And then they go on to say the benefits are, are many. We're going to talk about the potential benefits later. But obviously, the Business Development Bank of Canada really believes in corporate social responsibility and wants to promote it in all aspects of what a corporation does. The problem is that a business also does have a duty to its stakeholders. And if you take a look at source number two, article from the Globe and Mail from about 10 years ago, called A Canadian Understanding of Director Duties, you get a little bit of a taste of what's involved in terms of the duty to shareholders. The Supreme Court of Canada's landmark decision in the BCE case, which we're going to talk about in a moment, sets out a distinctly Canadian understanding of directors' fiduciary duty and has important implications for how directors make decisions. If someone could explain to me after we've read this why this is distinctly Canadian, I'd love to hear that. But let's read what the case was. The case concerned a challenge by a group of Bell Canada debenture holders to the proposed acquisition of BCE through a $52 billion plan of arrangement. They objected to the arrangement on grounds that it would result in the loss of Bell's investment grade rating and reduce the value of their debentures. So Bell Canada has stakeholders who are objecting to an acquisition because it will damage their rating, the rating of Bell Canada. Okay. The Quebec Superior Court approved the arrangement. In a decision that rocked corporate Canada, the Quebec Court of Appeal overturned that decision and ruled the transaction could not proceed. The Court of Appeal found that BCE's directors had a duty to consider debenture holders' non-contractual interests and were required not simply to accept the best offer for shareholders, but to consider whether the arrangement could be structured in a way that provided a satisfactory price to the shareholders while avoiding an adverse effect are the debenture holders. So you have to consider the shareholders in structuring this deal. In a unanimous decision, the Supreme Court overturned the Court of Appeal and reaffirmed its holding in People's Department Stores v. Wise that the director's fiduciary duty is owed at all times to the corporation and not to shareholders or any other stakeholders. So it's a back and forth. And now we get to the key part. Although the Supreme Court said that in considering what is in the best interests of the corporation, directors may look to the interests of various stakeholders, in practice, directors will need to consider the impact of their decisions on affected stakeholders. So they said that they may look, but in practice, they have to look at the effect on stakeholders. This is because the Supreme Court found that the duty of directors to act in the best interests of the corporation, quote, comprehends a duty to treat individual stakeholders affected by corporate actions fairly and equitably. In circumstances where stakeholders' interests conflict, the court noted there is no principle that one set of interests should prevail over another set of interests. Everything depends on the particular situation, .. But you have an obligation fundamentally to consider the welfare of the stakeholders of the corporation and the impact on them. Why is that uniquely Canadian? Can anyone explain that to me? We're not going to go through the entire thing with everybody on mute. What is it about this that's uniquely Canadian? Okay, so you don't know, and I don't know. Nonetheless, the message that emerges is you do have a duty to consider the welfare of the stakeholders, the shareholders, and so when you're calculating what you're going to do for CSR, for corporate social responsibility, you have to take into consideration the desires of the people who have invested in your company. It's not as simple as saying whatever the community wants is what we're going to do. This is not only a conflict on a secular level, it's a conflict from a Jewish perspective as well. On the one hand, Judaism very clearly blends business with chesed, right? Chesed, acts of generosity. There is an obligation from a Jewish perspective to invest our businesses with the same values that drive everything else we do. As an example, take a look at source number 3, please, from the Rambam. This is a fairly well-known passage in the Rambam, but I think people sometimes miss the implications of it. The Rambam created a structure, a hierarchy of levels of tzedakah when it comes to helping people out. So the lowest level of tzedakah might be where I walk over to somebody and I see the person is in need and I hand them some money. Right? That will be a sort of very basic, low-level form of tzedakah. How could I improve on that tzedakah? What could I do that would improve the level of tzedakah that I'm doing?
Anonymity.
Anonymity. Good. Anonymity for whom?
Both parties.
Right. For both parties. Right? So it's great if I can provide anonymity for the recipient. So I give in such a way that the recipient's identity is not known to me. It's great if I can give in a way that the donor is anonymous as well, right? In the Beis HaMikdash, you had a room. And the way that it was structured was everybody would walk into the room and they would either donate or they would take. And nobody would know. Nobody would know who was giving and who was taking. Yes, Miriam.
The concept of the donor anonymity is not so clear to me, because isn't it sometimes really good that other people see that other people are giving in order to motivate them to give, or to show their children that they've given, so that they create sort of this is what is done? If everybody's anonymous in the giving, it may not be as motivating as putting those names out there.
You are quite correct. From a big picture perspective, we value donor recognition, and actually, the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo Ibn Aderet, writing in the 14th century, was asked this question about publicly acknowledging people's gifts, and he offered several bases within Judaism for acknowledging the gift, one of which is what you just mentioned, in terms of creating a culture of giving, and having people recognize that this is something that's going on, and not just going on, but going on by people whom they know. And by honoring that, potentially increasing the giving that goes on. There's a lot of basis for it. Nonetheless, on a granular level, in terms of a particular act, it's considered greater if the donor is anonymous. Well, take a look at source number...
Rabbi, not to go down a tangent, but if you give to a tzedakah organization, the individual receiving it doesn't know from whom it's coming, and yet it can still be publicly acknowledged.
Right.
No, there, support giving.
Right. There are definitely ways to do it. Umbrella tzedakos are a fine way to take care of it. So take a look at source number 3. The Rambam's highest level of tzedakah. And in the interests of time, I'm just going to read my English translation, but you can see the authentic original Hebrew as well. The highest level of tzedakah, beyond which nothing is higher, is to give him a gift or a loan, or create a partnership with him, or provide him with work to strengthen his hand until he no longer needs to ask from others. So the ideal form of tzedakah is where you actually provide somebody with the means of being able to work, right? So you become an investing partner, and this person will be the managing partner. Or you lend them money, and they're going to use it now for a business purpose and ultimately pay you back. You bring somebody in as a business partner. When you think about it, what the Rambam is really doing is he's saying your business should also employ the value of tzedakah, the value of aiding others. It's not that I have one life in which I'm a person of religion and I donate to people, and I have another life in which I engage in business and try to support my family. I am turning my business into an act of tzedakah by bringing somebody in to the business who is a person in need. Now, there are limits on this. You know, I've quoted in other classes the comment from Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, a judge in Israel, talks about the case in which I own a grocery store, and somebody who is very hungry, like devastatingly hungry, comes into the store and asks me to give him from the produce that I have out there on the shelf. But I'm going to lose my inventory by doing so. So, unless the need is dire, like the person is starving to death, I'm not expected to undermine my business and hand him the apples off of the shelf. So, there are limits to what we're going to expect. Nonetheless, the fact that you're called upon to bring the person in as a business partner testifies that business is not separate from chesed. The two are supposed to work together. At the same time, if you take a look at source number 4, from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, talks about my responsibility to my business partners. One who partners with another party without declaring specific policies, unless we set specific policies for the business relationship, I may not vary from local custom for this kind of merchandise, whatever merchandise we're dealing with. May not travel elsewhere, may not partner with others in it, may not work with other merchandise. If I enter into a deal with somebody in which I am going to be managing certain assets, I have to follow whatever local custom is. That's a basic duty. In other words, I have a responsibility to the person who entrusted me with this job to look after whatever the goods are, whatever the merchandise is, in a responsible way. There is a duty to shareholders. One second, Miriam. Just to explain what I'm trying to draw from here. It's not as though I can say to my investing partner, yes, I know you really wanted me to do X. However, if I do it differently, I could really help the community. I have a responsibility to this person to act in the anticipated ways, the ways that were anticipated when we formed the partnership. Yes, Miriam.
So that principle, could it be seen to just emanate from the Haftalah?
So I'm not hearing you.
Would it emanate from the concept of Masha Sanua Lecha, Al Tase Lecha Vercha? Just like you wouldn't want him to do that behind your back and make, executive decisions that he thinks is in the best, you can't do that to him.
Right. So that's for sure a fine ethical motivating factor, but we're a little more hard-nosed when it comes to business, and it's not only about the fact that, you wouldn't want this done to you and that kind of thing. It's also the fact that you have a contractual agreement. You are required to guard the person's property and take care of it in the anticipated way. That was those were the terms under which you entered the arrangement. So that can be an underlying ethic, but it's expressed in more specific terms. So what I want to do here in the next, 40 minutes, it's always shocking to me to go from the business ones and the legal ones, which are an hour and a half, to go to the medical and legal ones, which are an hour and a half, to these, which are an hour. What I want to accomplish is to address the set of questions that you see after source number 4 on the source sheet. What is included in corporate social responsibility? Why would we expect a corporation to be involved in this if it could, in fact, harm stakeholders, shareholders and stakeholders? And who decides whether a corporation should take on a particular CSR initiative? Do you have to poll everybody? Is somebody entitled to make that decision? And then the last bit, which I doubt we'll have time for, but I have sources on here that relate to it just in case. We have a concept in Judaism of dina demalchusa, the law of the land is the law. So does legislation requiring CSR have binding authority as dina de machusa, as law of the land? Those are the questions that we're looking at here. Okay. One more pitch, please, just to make sure. I think at this point we have the people on who are going to be on. If you didn't sign in advance, please make sure that you send me a message in the chat. And if you didn't get the email in advance from me with the materials, please make sure that you include your email address when you message me to make sure that that I'll be able to note that you were here. Having your screen on is a bonus, because then I can really know that you were here. Okay, so corporate social responsibility. We've given it a vague definition. We talked about shaping the policies of a company in a way that will fit the values of the surrounding society. But I want to go a little further. There are three different directions that you can identify for social responsibility with possible applications that we'll mention here. So for example, there is CSR towards your employees, right? In terms of, we already mentioned, making sure to hire minorities, or making sure to hire women, or paying a certain wage. There is CSR when it comes to dealing with your partners. So not profiting from sweatshop labor or underage labor, potentially. And then there's CSR towards the community. So investing profits in local vocational programs, mentorship programs, protecting the environment. And again, I'm not weighing in on any particular initiative, just identifying initiatives that are out there that tend to be included under the umbrella of CSR. But I actually wanted to focus more, for the moment, on not the SR part of CSR, but on the C part of CSR, corporate social responsibility. Meaning, all of these values, right, hiring people from underrepresented groups, taking care of the environment, presumably these are responsibilities of individuals as well. It's not about a corporation per se. So why do we talk about corporate social responsibility?
Maybe because the corporation has an anonymous face. Whereas, and so you think, even where it's like, you know, hidden behind a corporation name and not, you know, Mr. X or Ms. X's business, you know, where it's more hidden and so easy to not go for this the responsibility, because I would think it would be called business social responsibility, but the fact that it says corporate, there's something there. Like, take what's hidden and even they should be.
So it's even the corporation. Even the corporation has responsibility. Okay. Other suggestions? I'm not disagreeing with that, but other ideas?
It seems to me
the
question revolves around whether the corporate is an individual or not.
Right. So certainly from a Jewish perspective, that's something we're going to have to visit, is how exactly do we look at a corporation? Is it a set of individuals? Is it its own thing? So we're definitely going to need to go there. From a secular perspective, it seems fairly clear that, number one, they would like social responsibility from everybody, and number two, they consider corporations to be persons, so to speak, such that they have the responsibility. I think that the anonymity of it and the possibility of hiding behind the fact that it's a corporation is a piece of what leads it to be emphasized, but I think it's also because corporations have the means to do it effectively. Corporations, as a general principle, not universally so, but as a general principle, are the ones who have the money at their disposal, the resources at their disposal, to be effective. Individuals tend not to be viewed as being all that effective. So what we're saying is, even though this business is not a particular individual, it may even be publicly held, social responsibility is still a mandate, because we think that society needs you effectively to be responsible. There's also another element, which I'm going to bring a Jewish source for, but it's something that extends, I think, to the secular thinking as well, which is in source number 5. Source number 5 is a ruling from a rabbinical court in Israel, dealing with a case in which evidence was needed for a particular case, and there was a communal organization that had the evidence and said, well, we're not bound to provide it. So take a look at source number 5, where the court says, again, reading my English translation, just as each individual is summoned to release his concern and worry for his own in order to protect the next person's needs, so a community, via its representatives, may not go too far into concerns and may not make many calculations when the question arises of fulfilling their debt to the individual, right? Just like the individual has an obligation to forgive their own rights and their own concerns in order to help others, the community does too. for with the community too. If they were to perpetually be exacting, saying mine precedes, mine comes first, they would remove the yoke of generosity and tzedakah from themselves, and they would be a bad model for individuals. If you create a situation in which corporations can get away with things because we are anonymous, then no one is going to look out for others. So I think there's the issue of the corporation as an influence on the community as a whole that matters. If I look at Bell Canada and say, well, Bell Canada isn't concerned about this, so, you know, why should I be concerned about this? So therefore, there's an issue. That's all from a secular perspective, including that last reference, even though I brought a Jewish source for it. But in Judaism, we actually come back to Dr. Zaffer's question, which is, how do we view a corporation? This question always comes up Pesach time. It's a very popular Pesach question, because if I own shares in a company that owns chametz, am I considered to own chametz during Pesach? Or do we say a corporate is not the set of its members? The corporate is something unique and apart and not identified with me, and therefore the fact that the corporation owns chametz doesn't affect me. So that's where this question is most frequently asked. But the question here as well is, how do I view the corporation? Clearly individuals are obligated to be socially responsible. That's very clear. And I brought you a few sources on this that I think are worth recognizing. First of all, source number 6, Ramban, right? Moses Nachmanides, talking about the principle of Kedoshim Tihyu. When we are told in the Torah that we shall be holy, so Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, the Ramban, in source number 6 explains, the Torah prohibited arayot, forbidden sexual relations, and forbidden foods, and it permitted marital relations and eating meat and wine. So there are things that the Torah says don't do. There are things the Torah says you're allowed to do. And he says, within the context of those things the Torah permits, a hedonist could find a way to be immersed in impropriety, drinking wine, eating meat gluttonously, speaking as he wishes of all depravity, for no prohibition in this regard is mentioned in the Torah. He will be what's called in the Hebrew naval birshut ha-Torah. He'll be depraved within the bounds of the Torah. Therefore, the text, meaning in Vayikra and Leviticus, followed its list of explicit prohibitions by instructing us as a general rule that we should be separated from permitted practices. There are things that the Torah did not say, this is off limits, and yet they are off limits. You're just supposed to figure it out. Why didn't God not just tell me which things are prohibited? Why does God leave certain things to me? So there are a lot of different explanations, but my favorite explanation is because it's good for a human being to develop an ethical personality. If all I am is a rule follower, so you told me which things I can't do and which things I may do, then I end up stunted. I'm just, you know, I'm a computer. That's all it is. I need to learn to think about what I should be doing and what I should not be doing. And God says, I'm giving you your starter set, and it's up to you to go from here. But it's not only about prohibitions. It's also about positive activities. If you take a look at source number 7, on the verse in the Torah that says, Ve'asisa hayashar ve'hatov, you shall do that which is righteous and good. So in source number 7, Nachmanides again, he says the Torah could not state all human conduct with neighbors and friends and all interactions and the needs of civilization in all nations. But after it mentioned many of them, it returned to state a general rule to act in the way that is good and straight in all matters. So his view is, what he's articulating here is, the reason why the Torah doesn't say every possible rule is because you can't. However, I'm saying there's an additional value to us figuring it out. I bring you this Ramban only because it shows not only in terms of separating from acts that are prohibited, but also in terms of doing things in addition, taking on practices that are positive, we are given a mandate of trying to evaluate what we're supposed to do, what we're not supposed to do, and being, as we said, socially responsible. I heard someone unmute for a question. Is that? Nope. Okay. So, taking that a step further, beyond this, we have a concept called Lifnim Mishurat Hadin, which means what? What does Lifnim Mishurat Hadin mean?
Beyond the letter of the law.
Yeah, beyond the letter of the law, beyond that which the law demands. And this is often explained, looking back Talmudically, as forgiving one's rights. When I have a legal right to demand something from somebody else, nonetheless saying I'm not going to make that claim. So if you take a look at source number 8, there's an example of this. Story of Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, an elder. He's walking on the road, and he sees somebody who's carrying a load of wood. The man who's carrying the wood puts the wood down, and he rests. Then the man who had the wood says to Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, pick it up for me. There is a mitzvah in the Torah of helping people with their burdens. So, pick it up for me. Rabbi Yishmael says to him, well, how much is this worth? The guy says it's worth half a zuz. Okay, if your mind is not yet in Pesach mode, consider that for 2 zuz you can get a young goat. So this is a quarter young goat. Rabbi Yishmael pays the guy half a zuz. He says, I can't help you pick up the wood. I'll buy the wood off of you. So he gives the guy the money, and then he declares the wood ownerless because he's not doing anything with the wood. So the man, smart, says, huh, I'm picking the wood back up for myself. He acquires the wood. He does some kind of action of acquisition. Then, of course, he wants help with the wood. So Rabbi Yishmael gives him another half a zuz and again declares the wood ownerless. Well, the man is going back to claim it yet again, right? This is a good business deal. He's very happy that he encountered Rabbi Yishmael. And Rabbi Yishmael this time says to him, I've declared it ownerless for the world, but not for you. It's not ownerless for you. The Talmud then has a nice discussion of whether that actually works. Is there a legal construct of ownerless, but not for you? But then it asks the question. Rabbi Yishmael, son of Rabbi Yossi, was a zakein. He was an elder. He was exempt from the obligation to pick this up. The mitzvah of helping people with their items is not bound upon, does not bind everybody. He was exempt. And the answer is, yeah. But he went beyond the line of the law. He could have said, you don't have a claim on me. But he went, lifnim mishurat hadin. He went beyond the line of the law. There is a responsibility to go beyond that which somebody can claim from us, and we are meant to employ our conscience in this regard. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, in source number 9, in an essay called Religion and Morality, talks about this. He says, surely in relating to halakha, including those areas which one may find morally difficult, there is some role for conscience, some role for the goodness in us, particularly in an interpretive capacity. Conscience does and legitimately can have a role in helping us to understand the content and substance of the tzav, of the divine instruction. So what we've established, I hope, is that there's a level of personal social responsibility in Judaism. What about the corporation? So if I view the corporation as a set of individuals, then individuals also have the duty, not only the corporation, right? First of all, in terms of not profiting from something inappropriate, so I, as an individual stakeholder in the company, should not be a beneficiary of impropriety. And in terms of going out and helping, I have a duty to assist others. In source number 10, I brought you Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. I'm not going to read it aloud now, but you can see it there. I'm talking about communal spending for healthcare. I've quoted this in other classes as well. And he argues that the community is a set of individuals. And just like an individual is required to look after the medical status of others, so too the community is, because the community is a set of individuals. That's Rabbi Waldenberg's philosophy. So you could say, hang on one second, Miriam, you could make the argument that that the corporation is just a set of people, that halacha does not recognize the legal fiction of saying the corporation is a separate thing. And therefore, all the people who invest in the corporation, all the people who work for the corporation, are obligated in social responsibility just like they are on their own property. Yes, Miriam.
So in a situation like a modern situation where corporations are very complex and stakeholders don't know the minutiae, maybe even some of the big details, as much as information may be public to a certain degree, does that mean because I can't really know what a corporation is doing, especially, let's say, a big one, that I shouldn't invest in a corporation because I won't be able to monitor the situation to the degree that, let's say, halakha might expect of me.
You can certainly make that argument. Ignorance is no protection. You know, I mean, you can certainly make that argument, yes.
But we don't really tell people and you know, don't invest in mutual funds, don't invest in corp. We don't really tell them that holistically, do we? Do we say be more cautious and because of ethics, stay away from these type of investments, which are very common, you know, investments in our portfolios?
So it's a good question. I'm gonna hold it 1 second because Paul wanted to say something, but I'm gonna come back to it. Yeah.
What about a situation such as like SNC-Lavalin, which is in the in the news and got caught in doing some things that are not say honest? Does that now put us in an onus on the if you were a shareholder of that company to then say, hello, you know what, I gotta wash my hands from this company and sell off?
So the argument can definitely be made. I mean, if I view it as you are an individual and you're acting for yourself, even though it's in the context of a corporation, then I think that is a responsibility. I think that does become a responsibility. Where we have to go is what if corporations have a separate status, which frankly is the majority view in Jewish law. Certainly on a practical level come Pesach time with the question I mentioned before about chametz. But I think it's a legitimate question. I think that we should be asking that. You know, I admire the fact that in the Muslim world they have investment funds that are targeted to what they call Muslim values. I haven't seen that in the Jewish world, that there are Jewish investment funds with that kind of mission. Maybe I'm just not aware of them. But I haven't seen that. The other Paul.
I almost responded to the first one. I didn't see all the polls on there. Does it matter how minuscule your share is, as opposed to being a business partner where you're a 50% shareholder or whatever, if you have some very tiny, minuscule fraction of Bell or a bank or something like that, does that make any difference?
I think that's an interesting question. I don't know. Because on the one hand, I'm sympathetic to your point that I am not really the one who's doing whatever it is, and they're going to do just fine without me. On the other hand, the dividend I get is real to me. I'm not erasing the dividend that I'm receiving. And of course, in the background behind all of this, I'm thinking about GameStop now and everything from this past week and the influence that individual shareholders apparently can have on the fate of a company.
When grouped together as a large number.
Yeah. So you do have to wonder a little bit. I don't think it's trivial. Yes, Dr. Saver.
Yesterday's Toronto Star has a big system, not theirs, somebody else's, where they rate corporations on their corporate responsibilities and they give them a score. They have the list of the best 10 Canadian companies who are socially responsible.
Interesting. So in order for me to
if I may, I would suggest that in some of these cases, the rating is based on the political viewpoints of the people who are doing the rating. So I think we have to take some of that stuff with a grain of salt.
Right.
I would point out two other things. One is point out that there are ethical funds out there. They're not driven by Jews, but they're also not driven by Muslims, but there are ethical funds out there. The other point I would ask is, perhaps as a shareholder with only a limited vote, you wouldn't have a say, but maybe there's a higher standard of care in this respect for directors.
Mm-hmm. I would definitely agree. First of all, I want to go back to your first point. And that was what I was planning on adding there is you have to, we've been very vague about how we've defined the community's values. I would also add to that point that we haven't gotten to the question yet of, so how do you balance your social responsibility versus your duty to the stakeholders? That's something we still have to address. And it could be these companies are, in fact, wonderful in terms of their social responsibilities, but are not taking care of the responsibility to the stakeholders. So that's another feature that has to be considered. But in terms of Larry's latter point, the issue of the director having greater responsibility, I definitely think so. In the same way, to apply another Pesach thing to this, we talk about chametz she'avar alav haPesach, right? The issue of a company that owns chametz and is through Pesach and is selling it after Pesach, and the question of, well, are they considered Jewish owned or not? There, the opinion of many halachic authorities is that you look at the directors. You're not asking the question of the shareholders. You're asking the question of who the directors are. So that has practical halachic resonance. So in terms of the status...
One thing that reading the business magazine, you know, that there was a quote, and there's a court case in the U.S., I think it was the Supreme Court, where shareholders were suing the directors for giving away charity out of the company without their permission.
Right, so we're going towards that. I don't have that particular case. If you could send that to me, I'd be very interested. We're going towards there. I'm looking at the time and realizing we have 20 minutes left. So I think I want to go further. Mark, can you hold that, or is it directly? Okay, thanks.
Just a short comment. I was just curious. I wonder if there are any Jewish funds that don't invest in companies that comply with BDS.
So divestment from the divestors. Well, I think that's a good question. I don't know of any. There should be. In terms of this corporation, the status of the corporation, we've made the argument that the corporation is a set of individuals. But looking at the argument the other way, that the corporation is a separate entity, we do have that possibility. However, being a separate entity and not being a set of individuals does not necessarily mean you're exempt from social responsibility. We do have precedent in Jewish law for saying that even if a corporation is not a set of individuals, but rather a thing unto itself, it's a tzibur, to use the Hebrew term, they are still responsible for social responsibility. We have mitzvot that are applicable to a tzibur, to a community. For example, the Torah says, shofetim b'shoterim, you have to set up judges and officers. That's not a mitzvah incumbent on any particular individual. It is seen as a communal responsibility. The concept we mentioned before of lefnim mishurat hadin, going beyond the letter of the law and forgiving rights, is said to apply not only to individuals, but also its community. I gave you a couple of references on the source sheet in this regard, sources 11 and 12. I'm going to go with Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer in number 12. The case in number 11, the Ma'arach or Zerua, is talking about the sages in Magenza, in Mainz, in early Ashkenaz, who had a situation in which a member of the community couldn't afford the tax that the council had levied. And the position of Rabbi Chaim or Zerua was that the community should forgive its right to claim that tax from this individual. Take a look at number 12, though, because it's more explicit. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, gives the following story. A widow lived in a home sharing a wall with the Holy Synagogue. When the community leaders saw there was a fire and the harm from the fire was drawing near, the synagogue's in danger, they're concerned for it, and so they said, demolish the roof of that house and some of the roof of the synagogue as well. Well, miraculously, the shul is saved. The fire does not reach the shul. And he writes, it appears obvious they must pay the woman for the harm. One who saves himself with another person's property must pay. He says, first of all, letter of the law, you have to pay her. You can't save your property by destroying somebody else's. You have to pay them back for what you took. And then he goes on to say that even if that's not true, nonetheless, you should still pay because you shall do the straight and the good. V'asisa hayashar v'hatov. You should go beyond in order to reimburse. That's not lefnim mishuras hadin. That's v'asisa hayashar v'hatov, to do that which is right and good. The two categories actually have crossover. But we have numerous cases like this. Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss in the 20th century dealt with a case in which there was a butcher in South America, I think it was South America, who had a debt to the community, and the community had put a lien on his equipment in order to get paid back for the debt, and they wanted to sell off his equipment. And Rabbi Weiss said, you can't do that. You have to go above and beyond. So there is a sense that even if a corporation is not a set of individuals, but we view it really as its own collective entity, nonetheless, it will be expected to be socially responsible. So now I want to turn to the question of harming your shareholders. How do we deal with that problem? And I want to build up the problem based on an article by Professor Milton Friedman from 1970. Now, a lot has gone on since 1970. There's a lot of literature in the last 50 years about corporate social responsibility and arguments for, against, stakeholders liking Friedman, not liking Friedman. Yes, we don't have the time to go into a sophisticated analysis of the arguments, but I want to bring the arguments because I think they do matter. He is talking about corporate social responsibility, and he says, what does it mean to say that business has responsibilities? Only people can have responsibilities. A corporation is an artificial person, and in this sense may have artificial responsibilities. But business as a whole cannot be said to have responsibilities, even in this vague sense. He doesn't like the whole idea. He says a corporation is not a person. Your personal duty extends to situations only where you act as the principal, not the agent of others. That's number one. Number two, though, he says, this process raises political questions on two levels, principle and consequences. On the level of political principle, the imposition of taxes, he views corporate social responsibility as a tax. So he says, the imposition of taxes and the expenditure of tax proceeds are governmental functions. Here, the businessman, self-selected or appointed directly or indirectly by stockholders, is to be simultaneously legislator, executive, and jurist. He is to decide whom to tax, by how much, and for what purpose, and he is to spend the proceeds. All this guided only by general exhortations from on high to restrain inflation, improve the environment, fight poverty, and so on and so on. He says, you're taxing the people without authority of government, right? I realize I'm in Canada, but taxation without representation should have some resonance here as well. He says, isn't this just a non-governmental tax? And he says, who is the one who's deciding how to do this and making all the practical decisions? In terms of how it's going to be done, he says, that's a mess. If you flip on to the other side, still in source number 13, on the grounds of consequences, can the corporate executive in fact discharge his alleged social responsibilities? On the one hand, suppose he could get away with spending the stockholders' or customers' or employees' money. How is he to know how to spend it? He's told that he must contribute to fighting inflation. How is he to know what action of his will contribute to that end? He is presumably an expert in running a company, in producing a product or selling it or financing it, but nothing about his selection makes him an expert on inflation. Right? It's all well and good for companies to say, we're going to invest in whatever. And in truth, there are companies now that actually hire people. And they make them sort of the person in charge of CSR, and hopefully they have some kind of special expertise. But without that, why do you trust this person to do it at all? The same concern exists in Jewish sources, because you do have a responsibility to the person who hires you, or to the person with whom you are working, and there's fallout if you don't do what the person tells you to do. Right? The classic model, going back to the Talmud for business, was that you had investing partners and managing partners. If the managing partner doesn't do what the investing partner told him to do, you have problems. Take a look at source number 14 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. If one gives his money to his agent to buy wheat, you're the investor, you gave money to the managing partner, you said, go buy wheat, whether as merchandise or food, and he buys barley, or the opposite, then any loss belongs with the agent, any profit with the principal. Right? The way it works is, if the managing partner veers from what he was told to do, he's going to have to eat whatever loss is involved. You don't have the authority to just go your own way with it. And the best example of this is in source number 15 from Moshe Isserles. I have to credit Rabbi Dr. Usher Meyer, who writes on business ethics. He's affiliated with his own organization and also with Eish HaTorah. And he pointed this out. If you take a look at source number 15, he says, in a place where they customarily give a tenth from the proceeds, right? Where there's a practice that people give a tenth of the proceeds of their business to tzedakah, the managing partner may not give the tenth. He must give half to the investor, he has his own half. We're assuming just there's a managing partner, an investing partner, and each of them gets 50%. So he has to give the money to the investor, and he will give it to whomsoever he chooses. You don't have the right to give tzedakah on behalf of your shareholders. The shareholders will give the tzedakah. You can't do that on their behalf. So, why would a corporation be able to do this? From a secular perspective, Milton Friedman's arguments, and from a Jewish perspective, unless the shareholders have gotten together and said, this is what we want. Otherwise, why are you able to do this? So I'm going to give you three approaches, and I realize it's already 10:21, so I'm going to go straight on this point. Three different approaches. The first approach I bring just because, but honestly, it's not going to take you very far in the corporate world, and that is, don't worry about it, because there's a promise of divine reward. If you are going to do good things, God will take care of you. I brought you the Gemara in Shabbos. It's a classic. The Gemara asks, why is it that there are people, Jews in Israel, who are very wealthy? How do they become wealthy? And the answer is because they tithe, Shema Asrin. And the Torah says, Aser te Aser, you shall surely tithe. From which the Gemara says, Aser bishvil, either shetit aser or shetit asher. You could read this Gemara in two different ways. Either you should separate a tenth so that you will get more wealth and be able to separate a tenth again, or separate a tenth so that you become wealthy. Either one is a legitimate read of the passage, but either way, it's the idea that God is going to reward you. Good luck selling that to your shareholders, though. That's your first potential argument. Your second potential argument is, and you see this a lot in the literature, engaging in corporate social responsibility can help the company itself, can help the corporation itself. There is no conflict because CSR, if it's done well, is going to help your corporation. And the basic principle is customers, employees, government, society will respect your CSR and reward you for it. So in source number 17, I brought you from an article in the Globe and Mail by the president of Marriott International in Canada, saying to be successful, align CSR with business goals and community needs. And if you read the article itself, he quotes you a 2018 study that revealed that nearly two-thirds of consumers around the world now buy on belief. These belief-driven buyers will choose, switch, avoid, or boycott a brand based on where it stands on social issues they care about. So you will do better if you engage in CSR. I see a note in the chat from Paul number one, I'm going to call him because he spoke first, that giving the shareholders a special CSR dividend to use for social good. Yeah, you can make that argument. I think that Milton Friedman would be happier with that then the Ramah, Rabbi Yisraelis, would also be happier with that. But the argument is, people will appreciate it if you engage in CSR, and therefore your company will benefit. We do have all sorts of evidence in various studies that indicates that people value fairness, whatever they consider to be fair, right? You have the classic experiment, the 2020 experiment, the $20 experiment. You know this one. There are two people, we'll call them Reuven and Sarah, and Reuven is given a $20 bill, or not a $20 bill, he's given $20, and the rule is that he has to offer a percentage of that to Sarah. If Sarah accepts the percentage that Reuven gives her, then Reuven gets to keep whatever he's not giving to Sarah. If Sarah rejects the amount given to her, then Reuven gets nothing. So the question now is, what kind of offer can Reuven make such that Sarah will still accept it? So there are all sorts of studies on this. The study that I had read, they did 51 attempts, and in 45 out of the 51 attempts, Reuven offers a 50-50 split. He doesn't try to take advantage because he understands that there's something to be said for fairness, even though if he takes more, Sarah's still getting something. Nonetheless, he knows better. In 5 out of the other 6, Reuven offers a lopsided proposal in which he gets more than Sarah. And in 5 out of those 6 cases, Sarah refuses the lopsided proposal, even though that means receiving nothing. People expect a certain degree of fairness. People return wallets to strangers. People will even pay money to return a wallet to a stranger. And it's something that people generally value. So you see arguments for CSR that are predicated on this idea. Take a look at source number 18 as an example. From Innovation, Science, and Economic Development in Canada, a growing number of businesses have recognized an increasing consumer demand for products and services from organizations that take responsibility for their impact on the environment, the communities where they operate, their employees, their stakeholders, and the general public. Your customers will appreciate it. Another example of that, in source number 19, from Global Affairs Canada, when companies operate in an economically, socially, and environmentally responsible manner, and they do so transparently, it can create shared value. Identification and mitigation of social and environmental risks are increasingly important for business success abroad, as the costs to companies of losing community support in terms of social conflict, reputation, and the bottom line may be significant. So you're welcomed more by the community in which you operate if you are socially responsible. In source number 20 from the Business Development Bank of Canada, they talk about attracting a better class of employee and keeping your employees happy. Being a socially responsible business often involves higher material and labor costs, but there's a business case to be made for being a good corporate citizen. In a competitive labor market, employees are drawn to companies that have a good track record for responsible behavior, such as environmental protection. And reputation matters in this area. I brought you Dr. Moses Pava, professor from Yeshiva University, in source number 21, who makes the point that reputation matters in this regard. If everybody knows what you are doing, then altruists are more likely to dominate because people will reward the altruists. And in number 22, I brought you from Jeff Furman, Ben and Jerry's, and their corporate social responsibility enterprise, and how they believe that that was key to their success. So your second argument, your first argument is God's going to reward you. Your second argument is the business world is going to reward you. Your third argument, I'm going quickly here, is that altruism overrides self-interest. It could be you'll lose. That's possible. Nonetheless, even if you're going to lose, this is still important. And the Torah's mandates for helping others really aren't about profit. And they're not about what God is going to give you. The mitzvah of tzedakah at its core is give to others. It's not give to others so that God is going to reward you. We have a mitzvah, which I brought in source number 23, of intervening when we see that other people are in harm's way. You even, to a certain extent, endanger yourself to help others. There's no expectation of reward. And in source number 24, regarding the idea of going beyond the letter of the law, I bring you this very dramatic case. Rabbi Bar Bar Hanan has wine barrels. He hires porters to transport the wine barrels. I'm going to say it outside of the text in the interest of time, but you can see it there. The porters smash the wine barrels. They're clumsy. Barrels are smashed. He loses his wine. So Rabbi Bar Bar Hanan takes their cloaks as payment for his wine. Well, they complain to the sage Rav. Rav says to Rabbi, give them back their cloaks. He says, why? Is that the law? And he says, yeah. And he quotes him a verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs, so that you will walk the path of the good. Give them back their cloaks. They then complain and say, you know, we're poor people. We worked all day long. We didn't get paid. How are we going to eat? So he says, you have to pay them for their day's work. They smashed your barrels, and you have to pay them for doing so. And he says, why in the world? Is that the law? And the answer is yes. And he quotes the second half of that verse in Proverbs, you will guard the path of the righteous. So this is, according to one view, according to Rashi, this is part of the Lifnim Mishuras Hadin, going beyond the letter of the law. Others take it as pure chesed, pure kindness. But my point in bringing it is that altruism may override self-interest.
But next time you wouldn't hire that particular group of porters.
Yeah, that's probably true. That's probably true.
Maybe if they had paid you back, you might have, because, you know, everything was fair, and they're going to hurt in the long run themselves.
Right. Because it's 10:30, I want to make sure just to wrap up a couple of points, and I'll stick around for question and comment. But the secular economists also oppose doing this as a business interest. Milton Friedman opposes doing it as a business interest. He says, go ahead and do it. but don't call it a business interest. In source number 25, they, and it's a long source, but his point that he makes is calling it for the sake of business just means that your CSR is now fraud. Because you're doing it for the sake of business, then you're not really being socially responsible and helping other people. CSR, by definition, he says, is meant to say, look, I'm a nice person. I help people. If you're doing it to help yourself, then don't call it CSR. Call it business. Similarly, an article in the Harvard Business Review in source number 26 makes the argument that when you do it as a business initiative, you tend to damage the CSR part of it because you make your decisions differently. The decisions you'll make if it's just about helping people are different from the decisions you'll make if it's about helping your business. So, and these are good articles. I think it's worth reading. But the point is this. We have three approaches to justify CSR at the expense of shareholders. One is God's going to pay you back. Your second argument is it's good for the company itself. There is no conflict with the shareholders. This is good for the shareholders. And then your third argument is altruism overrides self-interest. Well, the third question we asked, and we're not getting to the fourth one at all, was whether a company should pursue a particular CSR initiative. Who makes that call? And I'm going to say this very briefly. If the reason you're engaging in CSR is this is good for the business, you don't need shareholder approval. Whoever you hired to run the company, who makes the decision about how to manufacture your product and how to distribute it, is entitled to make all the decisions that affect the bottom line of the company, including this one, because you're doing it for the sake of the company. So if that person decides that it's better for the company to hire these kinds of employees or to invest in this particular thing, that's the right of that person. In fact, it's the duty of that person to do so. However, if the motive is altruistic, then the managing partner may only act as instructed, or what the managing partner can assume reasonably that the shareholders would want. But it becomes very limited, because you really are responsible to the shareholders and their definition of altruism, not what you think it ought to be. And I brought sources to support this. To give one example from source number 29, when it comes to tithing Israeli produce, you're supposed to give a certain percentage to the Kohen, to the priest. But it's flexible. You can give as little as 1/60th of your produce and as much as 1/40th. So how does the managing partner decide what to give? The managing partner has to work based on what the investing partner would want. You can't just say, well, I think that we should be giving a lot. We should give 1/40th. You have to go based on what you know of what the investing partner would want to do. So in sum, what we've hopefully accomplished here, we didn't get to the legislative part of it at all, but we've defined social responsibility, corporate social responsibility, and the importance of the corporation specifically in that regard, even though they are anonymous, because they are so large and influential. They are expected to shape their policies to suit society's values. And that's something that we find potentially within Judaism. Certainly individuals have this responsibility. If a corporation is a set of individuals, it also has this responsibility. And even if it's not a set of individuals, it's its own entity, we have precedent in Judaism for saying that communities have social responsibilities as well. But it can harm the shareholders, as we've noted. So you have three justifications. One is to blame God. It's up to God. God will take care of you. One is to say this is a business move for the company, in which case the same people who run the business run the CSR. Or to say this is something we do altruistically despite self-interest, in which case you have to be very much in tune with what the individual shareholders want. And frankly, I'd be happier with the suggestion that was made of the CSR dividend rather than doing this in place of the shareholders' decision-making capacity. So thank you very much. We went a couple of minutes over, and I apologize. There's more to be said, as always. Thank you. I'm going to stick around for those who can stay. But very important, please, again, if you didn't sign in and you didn't sign in advance, you didn't register in advance, please make sure you send me a message. Thank you so much. So very much. Mark, you had a question? No? You're good? Okay. Jeffrey.
Yes, good. morning. That was wonderful. Just the end of your drush just reminded me of the Sherstein family back in Boston.
Yes.
When Malden Mills, their factory, then employed 3,000 people in a low-income part of Massachusetts, Lawrence, burned to the ground just before Christmas. And they kept their people, 3,000 people, on full payroll for 6 months.
Right.
Aaron was one of, was from family from Brookline, Massachusetts. He got a lot of flack for being a little too kind. Eventually, the company was back up and successful operating again. But they did go through two bankruptcies after, by 2007, they had to sell out to a vulture equity firm. And, their pension was unfunded. It was a little too much at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, it's actually a good example. I was actually at a talk that Mr. Feuerstein gave at Kutztown University when I was the rabbi in Allentown. Kutztown was about an hour away. So I heard him speak about this decision. And the whole speech was Pirkei Avos. Beginning to end, the whole speech was Pirkei Avos. It was a beautiful Kiddush Hashem.
Just one more point about the Feuersteins. When I was in law school, I was connected with, you may know this name, Sumner Kaplan, who was a political activist in the town of Brookline, a pretty prominent guy. I'm a retired general, U.S. Army, by the way. And, I got hooked up with him. We were working on a charity that was funded by the Feuersteins, and it was a little tiny charity, $25,000 seed money. But in order for me to be the treasurer of this organization, I had to go to the Feuerstein home and be interviewed by them before I took the position. And it was very much just like that. It was fascinating. It's a real, real wonderful family. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions?
So Richard Keener.
Yes.
Yeah. I was wondering if you saw an article in the National Post last week by Terry Corcoran in the Financial Post on the concept of ESG, environmental and social governance.
I didn't see
we
that.
Moved away from CSR into this whole additional area, and the concept of the warrior accountant, which is being talked about by the Institute, by the CPA Institute, that we should be pushing, actually pushing and advocates for this issue, this idea of pushing for ESG reporting, and that companies should be doing more on this front.
Wow, that's fascinating.
I'll send you a couple of links on it if you
want. Yeah, please do. It'll save me from doing the research, so thank you.
Anyway, shkoyach, thanks.
Shkoyach to you, thank you. Okay, be well then, everybody. Have a good day. And in May, God willing, we're going to have a three-part series like the one that we did in November. I would love to say that it's going to be at Zeifman's, where we usually do this in May, but we're going to be on Zoom. So I'm going to send out an email with the topics and dates, and I look forward to learning with you then. Bring your own lunch. All right. Be well.
Cheers.